How did our relationship to the change get so messed up? When I was a snaggletooth little girl of six, rocking my own brown skin girl version of Pippi Longstockings, braids, and frizzy hair, I had an encounter with an autumn leaf that changed my life forever. I was in the backyard of our home in Northwest Washington, D.C., dancing with leaves on a windy fall day. Suddenly, I experienced a sharp pain in my right eye. I rubbed my eye, but the pain did not go away. It actually got worse. I ran inside where my mother was in the kitchen, both eyes now streaming tears. "Something is in my eye, Mommy," I cried. My mother set me down and pulled my eyelids apart to gently examine my reddening eye. There was no evidence of an eyelash floating around in there, and my eyes continued to tear. My mother packed me up and walked me across the street to Dr. Jameson's office. He was our family doctor. His office was on the first floor of his private home in our all-black, de facto segregated middle-class neighborhood. His wife opened the door and escorted us to his office on that Sunday afternoon. He set me in a big chair and attempted to flip my eyelid with the edge of a Q-tip, thinking that I might have a foreign body in my eye. That was when I turned into a little whirling dervish of a demon and refused to let him near me. I kicked. I screamed. He was a gentleman who did not persist in trying to control me for longer than about 5 minutes. But of course, that felt like an eternity to my six-year-old panicked self. He sat down and, with an exasperated look from me to my mother, pulled out a prescription pad and wrote some words on it. He handed the note to my mother and advised her that someone would need to take me to Children's National Hospital in the white part of town for a more complete eye exam. He could not assess me further in my frightened and oppositional state. That trip was the first time I had ever been inside of a hospital. I remember fluorescent lights, the bustle of many people in the hallways and corridors, the smell of alcohol everywhere. I was not fighting any longer. I was fascinated by this strange environment. The doctor had suggested that I needed something called a slit lamp exam of my eye. All I had to do was sit still with my chin poised on a metal contraption while a technician moved lights back and forth across my field of vision. I had no foreign body in my eye, but apparently, with one of those dancing leaves, there had been a brush across my cornea that left an abrasion. That was the pain I was experiencing. Corneal abrasions are self-healing. I was sent home with an antibiotic ointment and a white patch taped across my eye. The next day in my kindergarten class, I was the center of attention for show and tell. I only wished that the patch had been black so that I could really feel like a pirate. It was after that experience that I began to think I might want to be a doctor when I grew up. Now, I imagine you might be asking yourself, why am I beginning our conversation about the change with a story from my six-year-old memories? Well, believe it or not, that is where we need to begin if we are going to reclaim our relationship to menopause. We need to begin with our little girl selves. That is because in this culture of top-down power dynamics in conventional medicine, that is where we go when we are subjected to overwhelming stress. I was taught in medical school that we humans regress to about the psychological temperament of a six-year-old. We can't hear what's being said to us. Our fear may lead us to strange attempts to control our situation. That might look like me flailing around in Dr. Jameson's office, or a freeze response into total submission. We submit, making no visible protest, but the traumatic medical encounter gets branded into our psyche for life. Many of us know this has been especially true for the medical trauma stories of our reproductive organs, how we come to know about menarche, about pregnancy and our childbirth options, about our lifelong cancer risks, and about menopause. In the United States, the change was something we didn't talk about. Up into the early 1970s, American women were left to flounder around with a physiologic change that conventional women's doctors minimized as not having any meaning at all. Practically speaking, my medical training taught me that a third of menopausal women would experience no symptoms worth reporting. Another third would have symptoms that were noticeable but not, quote, medically significant. And the remaining third would have symptoms that were intense enough to need medical interventions. I'm extremely hopeful that times have changed, but back then in my medical school days, my anatomy and physiology education regarding women's reproductive organs and our cycles was embarrassingly inadequate, shockingly inadequate. I will share more detailed stories, but not here. That would be a pop-out if it were on a computer. Times have changed in one dramatic way. Conventional medicine is currently fascinated with women's hormones. They are an extremely lucrative aspect of gynecologic, oncologic, and gender-altering treatments in 2023 America. Let's all remember how recent all of this is. Wyeth Eerst Pharmaceuticals' research into estrogen was originally considered non-profitable. That's in the early 70s. It failed trials as a chemotherapy agent for endometrial cancer. But pharmaceutical development noticed what estrogen did do. It slowed the rate of deterioration of bone in women with osteoporosis. So Wyeth Eerst did what any self-respecting for-profit corporation would do. Having developed the product, it researched the need, not really high enough, and stimulated that need. Wyeth Eerst Pharmaceuticals were primary funders of the National Osteoporosis Foundation. I hope I have laid a groundwork for ongoing skepticism and distrust in what your doctors may be telling you. Now fasten your seatbelts, because I'm going to move forward with practical observations and a review of attitudes and information about a most important piece of menopause and symptoms that frighten us a lot here in the U.S., urinary and fecal incontinence. I'm taking us straight into the land of taboo topics to get a grip on a foundational piece of our physiology about which we women have been kept ignorant. Our pelvic floor anatomy and physiology, and the consequences of what will happen when we don't take care of ourselves, matters. Pap smears and pooping. No one will argue that the position women have tolerated for pap smears, pelvic exams, and birth of our children is demeaning and humiliating. But did you also know that it is damaging to our physical bodies? Especially our pelvic floor. Now, I'm going to give details of the history, but that's also a pop-out because this gets very heavy very fast. By the 1920s, birthing practices in America were deeply influenced by one man out of Northwestern University who should be called the father of the modern episiotomy craze. Long story less long, this man single-handedly convinced American, that's mostly male, mostly white, OB-GYN doctors that they were witnessing a pathological event in birth. As that poor being born baby pounded its head unmercifully against the woman's perineum, it needed more space. The baby needed rescue, routinely. For the next 50 years, American medicine proceeded to rescue babies from the treacherous birth process offered by nature by enlarging the vaginal opening surgically with a 2-inch long by 2-inch deep incision. It sounds extreme because it is. This is a quote. Today's episiotomies are rarely performed, but as recently as 1979, 4 out of 5 delivering moms were having the flesh between their anus and their genitals snipped during childbirth. End of quote. That person said snip. I would say cut. As we women are experientially aware, conventional medicine rarely expresses much interest in us unless money can be made off of our reproductive health issues. This is especially true for women of color. We can wrestle each other to the bottom,
regarding who has been victimized and abused by this perfect storm of American misogyny, classism, and corporate greed. I have four specific examples that are very hard to read, and we'll talk just about First Nations people, enslaved Africans of the diaspora, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Oh, my goodness. So there is a lot of herstory trauma to consider, to take what you need for your own knowledge and evolution. I already said, this is a one-room schoolhouse where the references cited can allow the audience to go deeper or to verify the factoids that I'm telling you, or to wander off into explorations of relevant cultural or ethnic tidbits from your own backgrounds, not included here. But I return to the specific topic of this chapter, the harm done to American women with respect to our menopausal experiences and to our postmenopausal lives through quote-unquote advances in modern conventional medicine. Back to those unnecessary, finally proved significantly harmful episiotomies that were all the rage for 50 years of conventional American obstetrics and gynecology. Quote, after close to 60 years of widespread use, the episiotomy was racking up some alarming side effects. One of them was anal sphincter damage, cutting straight down from the vagina toward the anus, the method most common in the U.S. for episiotomies, posed the greatest risk for this kind of damage. Underlined, about half of women on the receiving end of the procedure suffered ongoing gas or fecal incontinence. Just take a minute to breathe that in. The amount of effects that have been delegated to the side with respect to women and our experience of conventional medical diagnosis and prescriptive recommendations are ridiculously high. My jaw dropped to the floor when I heard the statistics of 67% of women experience the side effect of sexual dysfunction when using many chemotherapy agents for breast cancer. Tamoxifen has a particularly grisly track record and some questionable evolutionary or devolutionary use of that particular substance in treatment of ductal carcinoma in situ. Again, this gets very technical, just keeping it light here. Who in their right mind is expected to choose a treatment option with outcomes in line with the flip of a coin? Well, women, that's who. Sadly, we are currently expected to tacitly accept treatment protocols and use of diagnostic tools to which no male would willingly submit. And I say this having taught many co-ed classes in women's health, where I will just ask a male in the class to come forward and simply assume the position, lithotomy position, fully clothed. Over half the time, the males have considered the exercise too embarrassing and will refuse. So if male medical students were put through that simple walk a mile in my shoes experience, perhaps we would have them come out the other end with a modicum of more empathy. My last example for this chapter on how our relationship to menopause got so confusing would be an exploration of the evolution of a test that is big business and something menopausal women can expect to experience, and that is the colonoscopy. But I'm not going to go into the four pages I wrote on colonoscopies because it's really, really terrifying to look at the evolution of a test and how we got to places where we get a lot of treatment when we really didn't need it, and not enough treatment when we need it. So I went on and just shared my own, as I said, prescriptive narrative, not trying to convince everybody experienced that. I'm 66, and I never had a colonoscopy. I carry no significant family risk for colon cancer or polyps. My story might be significantly different on risk-benefit were this fact not true. But here in the United States, I have seen too much of what I refer to as the medical boys with toys, meaning the disconnect between patient and colonoscopy has too much possibility of expanding beyond what I've already seen with other procedures.
and I don't want a specialist ignoring verbal feedback from me as they painfully round the corner of my transverse colon just so they can get a better look. I resist any procedures that involve conscious sedation rather than anesthesia, since often that doesn't keep you from hurting, but it keeps you from remembering the pain that you have experienced. And general anesthesia always carries an infinitesimally small but real risk of not waking up after that strange sleep. Consequently, our move here in America to routine colonoscopy for everyone 45 and older is worrisome to me. And at the same time, I want more use of the old-fashioned check for blood in your stool. It's a test done and needs to be done for BIPOC folks at earlier ages. Chadwick Boseman had a family history of a mother diagnosed with colon cancer at age 35. Abraham X. Kendi, diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer at age 35, had only one known risk factor, being black. And yet we have no increase in the basic screening, stool guaiac cards for hidden blood, despite black folks being 20% more likely to have colon cancer and 40% more likely than a white American to die from it. Again, take a deep breath, because I'm hitting y'all with the heavy stuff. At present, there are 5 ways that an American with the right medical insurance can be screened for colon cancer. Fecal occult blood test, that's the little cards that I was talking about that used to be called as a brand name Hemocult. 2, a sigmoidoscopy that only goes partially up your ass and into your intestines. A colonoscopy that goes across the entire area. A virtual colonoscopy, which is a fancy new CAT scan test. And DNA stool testing. The test that my primary care person prescribed for me at my last annual exam was a monster of plastic, non-reusable parts costing somebody, the federal government, Medicare's program, I don't know, about $300 a screening. It includes a fecal occult blood test and a DNA stool test. And the kit itself collects a huge amount of poop. It's the entire amount that you pass in one sitting. And I'm extremely suspicious about what's being done with all that crap. Because the same system that inadequately screens for colon cancer in populations at high risk, while overutilizing this super expensive, need support in a hospital suite colonoscopy option, and we're talking about $3,000 a procedure, also has become aware of the financial value of, quote unquote, healthy stool. Conventional medicine is using stool that has good microbiomes for fecal transplants into patients with irritable bowel syndrome, other gut disorders, and even some neurodegenerative diseases like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. One person's waste is another person's gold mine. This has been true for other bodily substances we never thought about, like our placentas after we birth our children and the foreskins of our baby boys. 60% of us, we are still circumcising our baby boys. And all that blood out there, and all those tissue samples, and I'm going to say the most infamous one is Henrietta Lacks and the cells that were taken for a biopsy from her cervical cancer. I thank the reader, listener, for taking the time to meander down this strange road towards a deeper understanding of why so many of our needs as women are too often under-researched, over or underdiagnosed. We, as women, remain the other in a medical system that becomes more and more male the higher one goes in the hierarchy of the medical model. It might be a black or a brown woman mopping the floor in the colonoscopy suite after your procedure, but it is highly unlikely that the doctor performing the exploration of your colon, it is highly likely that that doctor is white and male. We women have learned to stay quiet, to not ask too many questions, to say thank you, even if the procedure or the treatment hurts. I am hopeful my health modules will leave you each with better advocacy skills and a deeper understanding of why it is vital that we learn to use them.